talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I ain't usual.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Welcome to the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
How you guys doing?
I'm doing great today.
Great.
How are
weekend.
You?
Okay, enough chit-chat. Let's get down to business. We got a lot of movies to talk about. It's that time of year. What is today? August
17th.
Oh, my gosh. It's Monday morning, and the weekend looked like Straight Outta Compton versus Man from U.N.C.L.E. Michelle, what the heck happened?
This weekend's top 12 domestic estimates. Number one was F. Gary Gray, Straight Outta Compton. It brought in an estimated $56.1 million, making it the number one film of the weekend. With a reported budget of $29 million, Universal Pictures' biopic is the sixth number one opening for the studio this year and the best R-rated August opening ever.
Now, were they expecting $40 million?
They were expecting around $60 million.
Oh, okay.
You say the best August opening ever of any movie?
Of our R-rated.
R-rated movie. Okay.
But yeah. So now, along with successful viral marketing campaign and terrific views, this really helped the film. So we'll see what it does. Mm-hmm. Count on a big Oscar push from Universal.
Okay. But Man from U.N.C.L.E. was right on his heels.
Number two was Mission Impossible Rogue Nation from Paramount Pictures. That was number two with $17 million, starring Tom Cruise, Rebecca Ferguson, Jeremy Renner, Simon Pegg, and Alec Baldwin. The film maintained the overall number one position both worldwide and overseas for the third consecutive weekend. The fifth in the franchise, MI5, is now closing in on the $400 million mark globally. So that brings us to number three. Guy Ritchie's Man from U.N.C.L.E. was third.
Bombed,
Warner Brothers saw only $13.5 million in paltry ticket sales. It still has a big rollout in Japan and other countries, but a sequel is highly doubtful.
I stayed for the end credits at the end of it. It's not like a Bond film. They didn't say Man from U.N.C.L.E. will return because he's not returning.
But they love Man from U.N.C.L.E. in Japan, so it'll probably break.
So at number four was, speaking of, Fantastic Four from 20th Century Fox. It slipped even farther into the abyss.
70%, I think I read, it dropped.
$8 million dropped off a staggering 69%, and the total now stands at $41 million. Number five was writer-director star Joel Edgerton's psychological thriller. That was number five with $6.5 million with The Gift.
Uh-huh.
Number six was Marvel's Ant-Man at $5.5 million.
Wow.
That stands at $347 million worldwide. Number seven was Warner Brothers Vacation at $5.3 million. The Minions took the number eight spot. Universal Pictures animated film brought in $5.2 million and now stands at $957 million worldwide. Number nine was Ricky and the Flash from Sony, $4.6 million. Trainwreck from Universal was the number 10 spot with $3.8 million. Starring Amy Schumer, the film has a global total of $111 million. Number 11 was Pixels from Sony. That was at $3.4 million. Believe it or not, Pixels is on its way to a $100 million take overseas.
Well deserved. Maybe. I don't know.
I wonder what the budget was of that. I don't think it's going to get anywhere near recouping their costs.
Exactly. And rounding out the 12 was the well-received Shaun the Sheep movie, $2.9 million.
Which I got to see last Monday.
You did.
Yeah, I did. Oh, that's just charming.
Isn't it?
Very entertaining.
Well, it's too bad it never did crack the top 10, though.
Yeah.
It was number 11 last week.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's just marketing, I guess, on that.
You know, it did well overseas, but here,
Yeah, so let's see if we could touch on a couple of the films we've talked about previously. There's a terrific article in Entertainment Weekly, the issue that's on the stands now, about what happened with the Fantastic Four film. And I think last week I was confused about when this infamous tweet went out from Josh Trank, and they say in the article it came out for maybe about a half hour or so on Thursday night. Bad move. I think I talked about how dreary the photography was. What I did mention was the only time that the photography was really crisp and clear is when they were in the hallway outside the lab when you saw the big glowing Dr. Pepper vending machine. Oh, product placement drives me crazy. But it's a terrific bit of reporting about it.
Well, let's start reviewing. Got a lot of movies to review. Let's start with Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, and you have a new code name.
Code name?
uncle.
Michelle's kind of been teasing us the past couple of weeks because she saw it about a month ago.
Yeah, and I mean, I liked it. Yeah, I was probably in the minority. But
Jim
I
and
liked
I it. Saw it last week. Michelle liked it a lot. Jim disliked it a lot, and I think I'm somewhere in between. Michelle, remind us again what you liked about Man from Uncle.
The visuals, the style of it. I like Guy Ritchie. I like the music of it, the costuming, the story. Granted, maybe the chemistry was lacking with Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer, but I thought it stayed true to the TV series.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I watched an episode of the old series a week or so ago. I had it on the DVR because it was the first appearance together of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy about 2 years before Star Trek. And, yeah, my problem was just it was probably not a good idea to open it so close to the latest Mission Impossible because the action sequences in this are kind of tepid. I think I mentioned in my review that I don't think they even measure up to the some of the stunt stuff from the Connery Bonds or even Derek Flint, James Coburn's films. And, Ilya Kuryakin, he's angry through most of the film. It's very odd.
You gave it 2 out of 5 stars, so that's that's pretty poor for you.
Well, I wanted to like it there. I wanted some nice 60s pop and kick, but I had a real problem with the villains in it, too. I just thought, the lady there, I think, played by Elizabeth Debicki, she has a little bit of a sleeky charm to her, and she finally sort of throws down at the end of the film. But her hubby in it, he doesn't really do anything besides just kind of look menacing at everybody. But I liked seeing Alicia Vikander in it. But it seems like after the second half of it, she just becomes the damsel in distress, the lady that must be rescued. And I was hoping that she'd go out with the guys and I think in my review I said go a little down and dirty and take on some of the bad guys.
She looked awfully cute in those short dresses, though.
Yeah, those 60s fashions were very, very nice. And I'd say the fashions, the look of the film was very nice. I wish, I was going to say that the photography might be a little too dark, but I think Tom, I don't know if we want to out the theater on this, but this is the second film in a row we've seen there where the picture was just so dark. And I'm wondering if maybe they're just turning down the bulb.
I think they might be.
To save some electricity. I think you're going to go see another film there this week. So maybe if that happens, maybe we should out them.
Perhaps, yeah. But The Man from U.N.C.L.E., I agree with both of you. I think it looked fantastic. It just had style to spare. The score was one of the best scores I've heard all year. The makeup, the clothes, everything looked great, but it couldn't coast on style alone as hard as it tried. It just had no momentum. There wasn't much to the story. Jim said the villains were a bit weak. I agree with that. There wasn't a whole lot of chemistry between the two leads. I think Henry Cavill acquitted himself a little better than Armie Hammer.
Tom, did you agree with me that he was trying to maybe do a little Robert Vaughn in there?
His
vocal delivery, you know what I mean?
Henry, But Armie Hammer's vocal delivery was like Boris Badenoff from the Bullwinkle cartoons.
And they kept
referring to him as a giant. Did you notice that? He's 6'4", but John Wayne was 6'4", and nobody called him a giant. Clint Eastwood, 6'3", Gregory Peck, Vincent Price, there's a lot of tall actors out there. He wasn't, Dolph Lundgren tall.
Yeah, it's true, I think I called him a blonde, blue-eyed Hulk in my review. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, he's, with this on the Lone Ranger, maybe he should do it.
People on Twitter saying just that he's become almost like the kiss of death.
Yeah,
with.
So maybe he should do another movie with his twin. They were so good together in the Social Network. So
I did like Jared Harris and Hugh Grant playing. I wish we could have seen more of them.
Well, Jared Harris seemed to be doing sort of this bulldog American accent, I don't know why they were doing that. I guess since Hugh Grant was playing Mr. Waverly, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
But, it just didn't grab me. And did you think, Tom, that this was certainly a subdued Guy Ritchie? Yes, I almost said Lionel Richie. Guy Ritchie
compared to some of his films, perhaps. Yeah. But he did do the whole split screen, which I like the split screen stuff.
See, I love that. With the music, with Daniel Pemberton's score.
It almost did succeed just on its style. I mean, it came close. It's the best looking movie of the summer, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely.
But like I say, the plot didn't grab you. It just sat there. And
Richie's next thing is the King Arthur movie, Knights of the Round Table. for Warner Brothers. So we'll see how that.
Well, I hope this puts him back on track, because I'm guessing this is going to have a hard time earning back its budget. You know.
Yeah, that's too bad. $13.5 million.
And that's mostly domestic. I mean, we'll see how it does overseas.
How much did it cost? Probably around $100.
A friend of ours today posted on Facebook, Tom, that he read that it cost $80 million. It seems fairly low, but I imagine you can still get a lot of the stars.
And they filmed all over Europe.
The cars
looked great. I mean, just
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I do commend it for setting it in the early 60s.
I love that. Yeah. I loved everything about it except the plot and the characters, which is kind of sad. it looked like some of the European 007 knockoffs, kind of like Modesty Blaze or Danger Diabolic.
Or Operation Kid Brother, maybe?
Nice.
It's unfortunate.
It is a shame, because I think it could make a nice franchise spy addition there to Bourne and Bond and Mission Impossible, it's not happening.
But coming so close to...
That was
MI5.
Maybe if they had waited a few more weeks, or maybe, well, if it got too close to November, you're approaching on Spectre.
Oh, yeah.
But the summer kind of ended with a whimper as far as that goes, because I think this past weekend was the sort of the end of the summer. We had the two big Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Straight Outta Compton, and then next weekend you have some smaller films, some movies that are going to sneak into theaters, some art films, and that's how usually it happens around September.
And it didn't help that it was going still up. Mission Impossible is not slowing down, and Straight Outta Compton, which that was going to be hard to beat anyways.
I hope you get a chance to see that soon, Tom. That is Compton is one of the best films of the year.
Listen, to be honest with you, I don't know anything about hip-hop, but I know that you're special.
You want to be involved with this gangster life? Here we go.
Speak a little truth and people lose their mind.
This isn't the Crips and Bloods. This is a threat from the federal government.
I was talking about on Facebook how that was probably going to clobber U.N.C.L.E. at the box office. A friend of ours said, well, what about those of us who don't like rap? And I was like, well, I don't care for rap.
Biopics
and,
alone.
You know, it's just, I care about good movies, and you know, that no matter what the subject matter is.
Well, Melissa Thompson reviewed it for We Are Movie Geeks and gave it 5 out of 5 stars. Mm-hmm. How many stars would you have given it, Michelle?
Oh, definitely 5.
And just Jim?
I probably would have done four and a half out of five, maybe.
So that's 14 and a half stars out of 15 stars between the three writers who have seen it. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Combined with like all the social networking, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, that really helped propel the film. Like I said, Universal, count on that big Oscar push. They had an official Academy screening on Saturday night.
Oh, really?
So that's Universal.
What categories do you think it'll be nominated
acting
for, perhaps?
Best Picture. I think they're still going to go to 10 at the most.
Editing. Jason Mitchell as Eazy-E. I would love to see him with a nod.
I'd love to see...
directing.
I'd love to see Ice Cube's son, and I wish I could call his name offhand.
O'Shea Jackson Jr.
Yes, I'd love to see
Corey Hawkins play Dr. Dre. It's just across the board. The cinematography.
Yeah, you know, it's strong, yeah. And there was some talk that Universal was saying that they were going to provide extra security, but I haven't heard of any incidents.
Not yet.
No,
over the weekend. You know?
Right,
if the screening we attended is any indication, people are in a real celebratory mood about this
film. Oh, definitely.
They're there, you know, not to cause a scene, but to have a really good time, and the film provides it. Mm-hmm. It's got comedy. It's got drama. The concert scenes are just amazing. They're electric.
That were the extras in that were true fans. They did not go to the casting office, so those were true fans of NWA.
Yeah, and
in the audience.
And there is kind of a timeless quality of the story. I think I had whispered to you what year this was supposed to be set in, because none of it feels really dated, except they're pressing record albums at the start.
Exactly.
But other than that, it's really,
and that opening scene when the school bus and some of the kids are listening to, you know, late 80s music. And
oh yeah, like I say, the actor, he's very, very good. He's got this great delivery of his lines, and really make the scenes extra funny. It's very, very well done.
I think it'll make a lot of the top 10 lists too, across the board.
Yeah, and it has probably maybe one of the best villains of the summer in Suge Knight.
Oh, it's his character, that guy.
He just you know, if he'd have been the villain in Man from Uncle, that would have been a lot better.
Is he in prison now?
He is.
He didn't make bail.
We spoke with F. Gary Gray at the press conference. Melissa Thompson spoke with him, and they said they didn't see that a year ago when they were filming his scenes. But he's wearing an orange jumpsuit.
So he can't see the movie
unless they show it. Sneak in. But boy, his villain is right.
Yeah, he's always kind of glowering at everybody. He's got the big thick cigar. Oh, yeah. He's got guys surrounding him that kind of look like him. They're linebackers.
Who plays Mr. Knight?
Oh, we'll have to look that up. But he's very good. Oh, yeah. I guess you could say that that there's another villain in it that's played by a familiar face.
Paul Giamatti. Is he dead on or what?
He's very good. He's not as menacing as Suge Knight's character is. He's not quite above board. You know that things aren't quite copacetic with him, you know.
Yeah, his the real life Jerry Heller has threatened to sue.
Oh, he's still with us. Okay.
He's threatened to sue. Well, he's like, that's not portraying me accurately.
I suspect it'll continue to do well also.
I'll be interested to see what the box is. The pacing is great. It does not feel like two and a half hours, seriously.
It zips right by. I think I've heard a couple of people compare it to a super episode of Behind the Music from VH1, and it is. And then I've heard some complaints from people that, well, you left this out and this out. Yeah. And I was like, well, it's a 2.5 hour film. It's tough to put everything in there. But boy, it's just a superbly done film.
Suge Knight is played by R. Marcos Taylor. Capture Suge Knight. I mean, yeah.
He's just a great bad guy. Mm. You know, he's right up there with the character name for the Mad Max film Fury Road.
Immortan Joe.
Yeah, I think him and Immortan Joe are maybe the best villains of the summer.
Of the year, huh? All right. Well, I wasn't able to see it, but I look forward to it. It looks like everybody else, though, we are movie geeks. Highly recommends Straight Outta Compton. So Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Straight Outta Compton were the two big movies this past weekend. Coming up this weekend is Hitman Agent 47, Sinister 2, American Ultra. We have not seen those films, but we're going to see them this week, so we can talk about those next week. But there are some smaller films opening Friday here in St. Louis. There's a movie called Jimmy's Hall.
There is something evil hatching in that hall. Broughton and his crew are atheists. So our community faces a choice. Christ or Jimmy Broughton's hall.
And you guys both saw that. I missed it. Michelle, tell me about Jimmy's Hall.
It's set in 1932... Ireland, when they're still warring factions deciding who's staying loyal to Britain. It's kind of the after who's staying loyal to Britain, who's really wants Ireland to become an independent state. And an expatriate comes back to Ireland to try to reopen this hall to bring everybody up to the 20th century of dancing and music and whatnot. And of course, once it opens and it's successful, the Catholic Church steps in and tries to shut it down and tries to have people arrested, and dancing and music is...
Well, I think the fact that these classes aren't sanctioned by them.
And they're not sanctioned,
and they
exactly.
believe Jimmy is a communist.
And they're trying to get him arrested. They're trying to,
I'm wondering, I think my favorite scene in it, Jimmy, as you mentioned, is an expatriate. He comes back after 10 years. He had to leave his love then, and when he comes back, she is settled down with someone and had a couple of kids. And there's a scene later on when the lady and Jimmy, I think her name is Uga, they're in the hall and they share a dance, and it's one of the most romantic, touching scenes in the movie I've seen in a long time, because there's just so much regret and longing between the characters, and it's almost a silent scene, and it's just wonderful.
Well, it's directed by Ken Loach, who's been directing these sort of small films that deal with social politics, and he's been around for decades making these type of films, and he's a very well acclaimed director.
It's almost borderline, starts to wander into the Footloose category.
Yes. Except, you know, the main priest in this is a little down on Jimmy than either John Lithgow or Dennis Quaid in the Footloose films. Mm-hmm. And it's great. Well, for us Sherlock fans, his assistant priest, Father Seamus, who is played by this actor, I think his last name is Norton, that plays Moriarty, opposite Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock, and he's sort of trying to be the calming influence. He's telling the elder father, it's like, you're just going to alienate your flock doing this stuff, you know, that you're coming down just way too hard. It's a really nicely done film.
It looks beautiful.
It's so green.
It's just...
Yeah. Do you guys both recommend...
if you're
Hall,
looking for a
like.
Little, small,
and Jim, are you
charming,
reviewing that?
I believe Kate is going to do that one.
Yes,
oh, okay, yes. Kate Marquis will be reviewing that for WeAreMovieGeeks.com. But Jim, you are reviewing End of the Tour, correct?
Yes,
and the
yes.
Tour also starts this Friday. And I think you're the only one in the room that has seen that.
What's this story about in your mind?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country, that sort of thing.
You're like a nervous guy, huh?
No. I'm okay. How are you?
Because I'm terrified.
Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg. Tell us about the End of the Tour and if it's something we should go out and see.
Well, it is. It is based on a true story. It concerns the award-winning author David Foster Wallace. It is about the end of his book tour. It's based on a book by a fellow named David Lipsky, and he's played by Jesse Eisenberg, and he is a sort of not an entirely successful writer who takes a job at Rolling Stone and convinces his boss, played by Ron Livingston, that they should do a profile of this writer. He's read his book, The Infinite Jest. You know, do something with him. And so they send him out to meet David Foster Wallace. It's up with him in his little sort of one or two bedroom house in Illinois, actually in Bloomington, Illinois. David Foster Wallace at that time was teaching a writing course at Northern Illinois University at Bloomington Normal, I think. And they're going to go from there to Minneapolis, where he's going to hit some of the bookstores. And it's just it's mostly a two-person film, but, you know, between the two fellas. And the real discovery here is the dramatic acting of Jason Segel. Mm-hmm. He is playing David Foster Wallace, and he is wonderful in
it. He's had some really good reviews out of some of the early film festivals.
Yeah, I think this could nab him a nomination, depending on what's going to come out at the end of the year. But yeah, his character always has this sort of a hippie bandana that he's wearing, and he's big into junk food. But there's sort of a haunted look at his eyes. He's really concerned about becoming a big star and sort of losing himself in celebrity and becoming a jerk. And he's also concerned about Lipsky delving too much into his past. He pretty much tells him, don't go talk to my parents.
Is this basically a two-character drama?
Basically. Of course, when they get to Minneapolis, they're picked up by their sort of the go-between, the representative of the publishing people, and it's played by Joan Cusack, and she's very funny in it. Turns out that both Davids have a love of sort of cheesy 90s action films, so they end up going to take in a film with one of David Foster Wallace's old girlfriends from college, who's played by Mickey Sumner, who is, I believe, Sting's daughter, who was so terrific in Francis Ha a couple of years ago, and by Mamie Goomer, who plays the book editor that first sort of knew that something was going on in this writing and decides to get him published, and she's, you know, kind of a fan. So they run around with them a little bit, and we find out that David Foster Wallace's main addiction, there was some rumors circling that he had a problem with drugs, but he actually has a problem with TV. He doesn't have a TV in his home, and of course, when he meets up with these ladies, he said, do you have a TV back at your place? And so he delves into that. But Lipsky is getting pressure from his editor to find out about these addiction and breakdown rumors, and he's conflicted about whether or not to spring it on, you know, Foster Wallace. Mm. It's a very well done film. Both gentlemen, Eisenberg and Segel are just terrific together.
That just opens this weekend at the Landmark Art Houses.
It'll
open wider?
There's a possibility of that. I'm thinking, yeah. Huh. So is it going to? I wonder if it's going to be at both Tivoli and Frontenac here in town.
Perhaps.
But you know, it's a very, very, very well done film.
Well, Jim recommends The End of the Tour, and look for Jim's review this Friday at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. A movie I saw over the weekend, a small film, was called Phoenix. We talked a little bit about it last week. We hadn't seen it. It's a movie. It's a German film about the Holocaust. But it's really more of a thriller that takes place after the Holocaust, and this woman had been tortured and mutilated by the Nazis, and she has her face fixed, plastic surgery, so she looks completely different, and she tracks down her husband, who she suspects had actually turned him into the Nazis to save his own skin. It's a pretty good thriller, although it's really, really far-fetched because you'd think this man who'd been married to this woman would be able to figure out that it was his wife pretty quick. And it's a little hard to make that leap. I mean, he even says, oh, you look like my wife. Oh, you have my wife's eyes. Wouldn't she have her voice too? and then he wants her to pretend to be his wife and pretend to come back from the Holocaust alive so he can get this money, that her inheritance or something like that. So it's a little convoluted and it's a little hard to swallow, but if you can make that leap of faith, it's a pretty decent thriller.
It sounds like it's got a lot of Vertigo elements in it, you know?
Yeah, it sort of does, and this actress, Nina Hoss, is quite good. You may remember her from The Most Wanted Man last year with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, yeah.
She looks identical to a Polish actress named Joanna Pacula. Remember her? She was in
Gorky Park. Oh, sure,
yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember when I was seeing Most Wanted Man, like, oh, that's Joanna Pacula, and then I thought, well...
Wasn't she in Breathless with Richard Gere? Was that
No, Valerie Kaczynski.
Oh, okay.
She was in a horror movie called The Kiss. She was a Polish actress. Anyway, they look almost identical. I even had to go look them up. But I guess Nina Hoss is probably a decade younger. But I sort of do recommend Phoenix. It probably won't be around. It may be around for another week. It was pretty packed when I saw it Friday night over at the Frontenac, but most Holocaust films tend to do well at that theater.
Yeah, so it's all set to about 1946, 47 there.
Yeah, set right after the war. Good movie. Another movie that all three of us saw last week that opens Friday, Diary of a Teenage Girl.
I really like sex. I want to get laid right now.
Do you like anybody?
Mom.
Ew.
You think he's kind of cute?
No, he's so old.
What'd you think of that movie, Michelle?
Don't let the title of the movie confuse you if you're a parent of a teenager, whether it's a boy or a girl.
Tell me about it.
It's definitely, it's definitely a hard R-rated film. And it's, I would say, if you were a teenage girl in the late 70s, this is mostly directed towards you. It's a definite young girl, coming-of-age movie set in San Francisco. She lives with her sister and her mother, played by Kristen Wiig, and she gets involved with the mother's boyfriend, played by
Alexander Skarsgård.
Thank you, Alexander. Yeah, Stellan Alexander.
Monroe.
So,
he's a bit of a kind of a druggy couch potato loser.
Yeah,
but he's hunky.
Yeah, and he's actually, I think he comes off pretty sympathetic, really, even though he's this kind of pervy guy, basically committing statutory rape.
Yeah.
But, you have to make him somewhat likable, because she is in love with him. Mm-hmm. At least she thinks she is. And if they had made him just a creepy, pervy guy, it wouldn't have worked.
Right, he has to have some
charisma. That was a tricky role for Skarsgård, I thought.
Yeah.
To sort of straddle that line.
He said in interviews it was a really fine line.
Yeah,
and how to play that.
It took a little bit of courage there to take such a role, I think, you know, because most of the audience is going to be split on that character.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and the reviews, people were split on how far the movie went with some of the sex scenes between the two leads. So.
Yeah, but the girl's 15, but the actress who plays her, and she's phenomenal, her name is Belle Powley. She's a British actress. Yeah, she's 23 years old, and she does these relatively explicit sex scenes. She does a lot of nudity, and she's just really, really good.
Yeah, I think when we were talking about it afterwards, a couple of people mentioned the movie 13, which that harkens back to. I was thinking back to a few of the sequences in the Nymphomaniac movies or Nymphomania movies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what I really enjoyed, of course, being a cartoonist, this girl decides to become a cartoonist. She starts to idolize Aileen Kaminsky, I think it's how you pronounce her last name, who was the wife of Robert Crumb, and sees her signing books at an underground comic shop and decides to do her own comics. So for a lot of the film, we're getting a little nice mix of animation of her drawings with live action.
Yeah,
and
mixed in there.
It's reminiscent of American Splendor,
Thank
if you
me.
Remember that from a few years ago.
That.
And it's very adult. It's tough.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a well-done film.
But that animation you mentioned, usually that type of animation just kind of drives me nuts. I think it's kind of precious, but it really works in this time. But at first, you know, you see flowers and teddy bears, but then as she becomes more and more obsessed with sex, which she does, and that's kind of what the movie's about, you know, you see animations of, you know, penises popping out of pants, and it gets a little more perverse, which is what the underground comic books of that time certainly had.
Yeah. Oh, and that cute.
And the rise of feminism. So
that's true. Well, yeah. And, you know, we were praising Mr. Skarsgård. Actually, Kristen Wiig is very good in a fairly small supporting role. But it's a good, strong, dramatic performance. And she might, there may be a couple of sequences where she's kind of funny, but she's, you know, not playing this kind of, you know, bizarro character.
You'll see it all over the Independent Spirit Awards at the, you know, award season. This will be all that kind of fair.
Yeah, yeah.
But last thing we seen him in was pretty much True Blood when it off on HBO. So
he was in that remake of Straw Dogs. He was the villain in that.
True.
He's been around. He's
I saw him in What Maisie Knew a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. But he came to the premiere, the New York premiere, right before it opened in full drag.
I saw that. Yeah.
For what?
For the premiere.
For the premiere of this film.
Why'd he come in drag?
It looks like the picture towards the end of the movie that she gives him, that she drew of him.
Okay.
There's a picture. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know why, but and he looked great. He looked really good. Yeah.
It was nice to see
Wrong with that.
Yeah, nice to see San Francisco not being destroyed, because it's taken a beating this
summer. Yeah, true.
So we do recommend Diary of a Teenage Girl. Jim recommends The End of the Tour. Also, there's a lot of smaller films opening this weekend, since we haven't seen the big films. Speaking of big films, Disney had a convention over the weekend, D23.
The D23 Expo. Yeah. Holy moly.
I guess it was sort of like Comic-Con in that they roll out sneak peeks at some upcoming movies.
It's just Disney and Marvel. Mm-hmm. It's the Disney, you know, the big empire. They rolled out some Marvel movies. They rolled out some Star Wars movies. They rolled out animated. They also made the big announcement about their new Star Wars land, their new Avatar land, new Toy Story land. It started on Friday with the animation side. We got to see first looks finally at Dory, the Finding Dory movie. We got to see, they announced Toy Story 4 and who's going to be in that. They also announced the Jack and the Beanstalk movie called Gigantic, which opens in 2018. We saw more
Have a Jack and the Beanstalk movie a couple of years ago?
We did.
Jack
we did.
That was sort of the definitive Jack and the Beanstalk.
Well, I don't think so.
This one.
I like that. I like that movie a lot.
That was the Brian Singer.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. We also saw more of Zootopia. And then it segued, so that was Friday night. Saturday night, we got to see the Marvel movies, and Jim will like this. They showed the first trailer for Captain America, and Chris Evans and Anthony Mackie showed up. They flew them in from Germany, where they're completing the final week of shooting.
Did you get a chance to watch that trailer either?
Well, I tried to, but I saw some comments. It looks like that's maybe a fan. Yeah,
But the new one, which Marvel/Disney will unveil soon, it picks up where Avengers... we see the Avengers fighting. However, but we also continue to see the efforts of safeguarding humanity against a new villain. And at the end of the trailer, according to reports, Ant-Man shows up.
Yeah, well, I heard about
Because of the post scene after Ant-Man, and they talk about Civil War.
Well, I guess I could talk about supposedly the footage they showed of Ant-Man meeting Captain America.
Yes,
he's shaking his hand. And he's like, "Oh, Buck, thank you for thinking of me." And I was like, "Oh, I'm shaking your hand too long, aren't I?"
Yep. In this one, it shows Steve and Sam confronting Bucky in a bunker, trying to establish if Bucky remembers who he was, and says, "Buck, you know me." With another scene showing Bucky going to battle alongside his best friend in the fight against Iron Man.
Hmm. Now, I saw some on-the-set photos last week online of Bucky, the Winter Soldier, facing off on the side of a building against the Black Panther.
Yeah.
So this is like the first, you know, photos released.
Who plays the Black Panther?
Chadwick Boseman.
Yep. He's in civilian clothes, extending his costume's claws, and ended with an amusing scene that saw Paul Rudd's Ant-Man meeting Captain America for the first time.
And Iron Man's pretty prominent in that trailer. Falcon.
Well, yes, I heard that there's
a lot of superheroes in
there.
Yeah,
I heard there's
not overstuffed.
Scarlett Johansson.
She says, "So if we do this, we still got to be friends." And he says, "Well, it depends on how hard you're going to hit me."
Well, didn't I spot Elizabeth Olsen in the trailer too?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's pretty much Avengers 3.
Yeah,
almost.
It looks like it. Or Avengers 2.5.
But without the Hulk and Thor, I guess, in this one. So.
Yeah, they said the fans just went crazy. They also showed Marvel also finally introduced Doctor Strange. So there was a video greeting by Benedict Cumberbatch, who stars in the title character.
Yeah.
They showed a little bit of footage that opens up in theaters October 26th. 2016.
Yeah, I heard they showed the some of the artwork, and he got a little chance to look at the costume, mm-hmm. and he's got the red cape, mm-hmm. so okay. you know that.
Yeah, they also showed Disney showed some of their other movies, Pirates of the Caribbean 5. Johnny Depp made a surprise appearance in costume. Mm-hmm. We saw Jungle Book, which opens up April 2016.
That's live action Jungle Book, correct?
These are all live action. Yeah. Yes, we saw the sequel to the Alice in Wonderland called Alice Through the Looking Glass. That's in theaters May 27th.
Yeah, I didn't know there was a sequel to that coming out. Apparently, Tim Burton did not direct it. It's directed by James Bowman, who did the Muppet movies.
Exactly. Oh, really? Okay. Exactly. And then at the final thing for Saturday was unveiling of the Star Wars movies. We are going to get a Star Wars movie, the big news, between now, 2015 and The Force Awakens, through 2019. Mm-hmm. So every year, you will have a Star Wars movie, whether it's a standalone or if it's one of the main core. The cast and Harrison Ford, who made a surprise appearance, came out to endorse The Force Awakens. It opens up December 2015. We also got Rogue One, which unveiled the cast photo featuring Felicity Jones and Diego Luna. Gareth Edwards from Godzilla is directing that story. It takes place prior to Episode 4, A New Hope, and it's about the Resistance fighters who have united to steal plans to the dreaded Death Star.
Oh.
That's produced by Kathleen Kennedy, coming out December 16, 2016. Then we have Star Wars Episode 8. Rian Johnson is directing that. That's in 2017. Then we have the standalone Han Solo film. That's in 2018. Yeah. And then we have Star Wars Episode 9, released 2019.
Wow. But you left out the most important announcement at D23, the remake that nobody has been clamoring for, Pete's Dragon.
And all of this is up on the site. Okay. So, yeah, they also had that as well.
And how can you do a Pete's Dragon without Mickey Rooney?
A dragon, I swear I saw a dragon, a green and seething fire-breathing monster is in sight.
Is Helen Reddy going to make an appearance in this one?
Oh, that would be maybe a picture. Maybe just a picture someplace.
There's a lot of Pete's Dragon fans out there. I was really surprised, you know. But it's sort of on Marvel News. I think we were talking a little bit about this. Ronda Rousey is going hardcore.
I love her.
Yes. Well, you know, I guess Entourage
Facebook,
earlier this
Twitter.
Summer was her big screen debut, but she wants to be Captain Marvel.
Oh, and she really does.
I guess she commissioned this artwork to be done of her as Captain Marvel. Differentiate that from the DC Captain Marvel. The Captain Marvel in the Marvel Universe is a woman. But there's a lot of artwork of her floating around the internet, you know, with that outfit, and she is campaigning hardcore.
Yeah, but can she act?
She was pretty much playing herself in Entourage, and I think she's got a big fan following, so I think they could, you know, get her some lessons.
Well, she's getting a lot of heat from the LGBT crowd because she refuses to wrestle women who used to be men.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I can't blame her. She says, you know, these women have the bone structure of men, and that's an unfair advantage, and she refuses to play along.
Well, I think she'd love to get in the ring with Floyd Mayweather, that's for sure. I don't know if that's calmed down any, but they got a little, they've been shooting little digs at each other the last few months. It'd be an interesting
choice. It would be, thinking outside the box. But this D23 Expo, I mean, Disney and Marvel between Star Wars, these new theme parks, Star Wars announcements.
I think a big announcement about the pirate films is that Orlando Bloom is coming back, right?
They had a picture, which we also posted with all the various stories over the weekend. Yeah. So that was a big...
He wasn't in 4.
He was not in the last one.
And what happened at the end of 3? Did he go...
Would come back off the ship every once in a while and
banished to an island.
Yeah, he was, and he had to stay there. So he would see Keira Knightley every 10 years type thing. And so he was there when Johnny Depp showed up in costume. And there's a great scene. There's a great picture that we have up of him talking with Harrison Ford. Hmm. So these two, you know, kind of Han Solo and Captain Jack Sparrow.
Oh, and they premiered the Drew Struzan poster for episode 7.
They did, and does it look fabulous?
Oh, well, you know, I love illustrated movie posters, and it's great. He's one of the masters.
Stuff to look forward to. So this weekend, Hitman Agent 47, which is a sequel to a movie called Hitman that starred Timmy Olyphant, a fellow named Rupert Friend stars in this one.
You know why you're still alive? Because I chose not to kill you, but they will.
I'm not familiar with this actor, but...
Well, I know that Zachary Quinto, Spock
that's
himself,
right.
is
yes.
in this. I guess he's playing his adversary or something?
Mm-hmm. Or his boss, I think.
Oh, his
that's
boss.
That's the impression
okay.
I get.
Yeah, oh,
okay. From watching the trailer. So we'll have a review of that next week. Sinister 2 opens Friday as well. That, you know, I saw the trailer for Sinister 2, and it looked really good. It looks really scary. I don't know why they're not showing it to us in advance.
Do you believe in evil? Something otherworldly?
Yes. You don't stop evil. You can only protect yourself from it.
But now I'll probably see it this weekend.
Now, the first Sinister, that was the one with Ethan Hawke.
Correct.
With
which
house
is super...
and all that.
Yeah, it's scary. He finds the 8mm movies up in the attic.
Right, right.
To show the previous family being murdered. It was quite good.
But yeah, the minute he's working at night, he looks out the window and the things...
Yeah. There,
I get Insidious and Sinister confused.
It's not hard. And then American Ultra opens Friday. That's also Jesse Eisenberg. It's like Jesse Eisenberg weekend at the movie.
I'm going to have a double feature of him on Friday.
Okay. And you guys are seeing that tomorrow night. I'll be at the Hitman Agent 47 screening. And Best of Enemies, which we haven't seen either, but that's a documentary about William F. Buckley.
And Gore Vidal?
Yeah, Gore Vidal. And
Bill Buckley was the first modern conservative to see that ideological debates were cultural debates.
Mr. Buckley, do you think miniskirts are in good taste?
On you, I think they are.
Yeah, I get a lot of footage from their appearances on TV, and I remember they'd get into it on the Dick Cavett Show and shows like that, you know. Mm.
So we'll have web reviews and our thoughts about those movies next week.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day.
And that was, of course, the theme song from Blazing Saddles by Frankie Lane.
Yeah.
Now, Frankie Lane, as you may know, didn't know he was writing a theme song for a comedy. He really didn't. If you listen to the song, it's actually a pretty straightforward lyrics, but it worked perfectly.
Oh, yeah. It set you right in the mood.
Yeah. Blazing Saddles is, of course, Mel Brooks' comedy from 1974. It's my favorite Mel Brooks movie. What about you, Michelle? Where would you put that on your list of favorite
Mel Brooks
movies?
My number one.
Is it?
Yeah, bar none. From beginning to ending. I mean, one of the writers on it was Richard Pryor.
Yeah. Well, Richard Pryor was supposed to play.
And he was supposed to play.
Star, but they couldn't insure him.
Yeah.
Now, Jim, you're the biggest Mel Brooks fan in the room. I remember when we were on Camo X a couple months ago, Paul Cook said, if you could meet any celebrity, who would you want to meet? And I said Burt Reynolds, which I stand by. Who did you say? Do you remember?
I may have said Sigourney Weaver.
Maybe. And then Jim said Mel Brooks. Where does Blazing Saddles fall on your list of favorite Brooks
films? It's fighting for second, you know, with the producers.
Oh, yeah.
But the original producers. But Young Frankenstein is my favorite.
Yeah. And what's phenomenal, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein came out the same year.
Unbelievable.
What a year for Mel Brooks had.
1-2 punch there. Yeah.
Gene Wilder, Madeline Kahn.
Everybody in Blazing Saddles is dead except Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks.
Yeah, there was some rumor last week that Gene was going to be doing a film for Spielberg.
Spielberg's trying to get him out of retirement.
Huh.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah.
But the reason I brought up Blazing Saddles is I belong to this club. It's called the Saturday Night Screening Club. My wife calls it the Old Man Movie Club. but it's a St. Louis group of older movie buffs. These guys are all in their 60s and 70s, and they all collect features on 16mm film. And they get together once a month, and they screen a movie out of their collection. Nice bunch of guys. Very, very knowledgeable about movies, especially old movies. They're all Laurel and Hardy freak. The movie that they screened over the weekend was Blazing Saddles, and I heard it was a TV print. At first I was kind of disappointed. I go, TV print. But it was actually fascinating. Blazing Saddles, the version that we're familiar with, runs 92 minutes. This ran 98 minutes.
Mm.
And apparently the TV print has several scenes that weren't in the original.
Yeah, I think we talked a little about it yesterday. I think I recalled seeing it maybe on CBS television, and they had included a sequence before the big fight in the fake Rock Ridge, in which Mel Brooks, as Governor LePetitmaine, comes to the fake Rock Ridge to make some sort of dedication or a speech or something like that, and not realizing that all the citizens are made of plywood and cardboard and things like that. And I remember then. I was like, I don't recall that from the scene at the movies.
Yeah, that was one of the scenes, and he does an imitation of he says, "What's your impression?" So he gets on his knees and he does an imitation of Harpo Marx. And he goes, "That's my impression of Harpo Marx." There's also another scene where Cleavon Little is messing around with Mongo, played by Alex Karras.
Oh.
And, you know, there's the scene where he gives him the box of candy, and Mongo goes, "I like candy." And but there's another scene that follows it where he puts Mongo in a diving suit, and he tells Mongo to go jump in this lake and search for some doubloons. And, of course, Mongo does. And then Cleavon Little goes, "Oh, I got to go to lunch now." So he leaves him under the water. That was a new scene. It was interesting, though, that the way they edited it for television, they say the N-word about 50 times in the movie.
"Hey, the sheriff is on this."
"What are you saying? The sheriff is near."
"No, God blame it, dang blame it. The sheriff is on this."
They didn't cut that out for network television. I guess that would have probably been maybe the late 70s. They left that in, but there's a scene where Cleavon Little sees this old lady and he says, "Good morning, ma'am." And she says, "Up yours, N-word." Well, they changed it to out of the way, N-word. So they cut out up yours, but they left in N-word.
At the time.
Yeah. And then Lily Von Stupp, played by Madeline Kahn, became Lily Von. And you can see him mouthing the word Stupp, but they just took it out.
Her character's genius. I love her.
The famous bean-eating sequence, which everybody remembers.
Oh, that.
You know, and these guys stand up, and there's these flatulent noises. Well, they took out the flatulent noises. They're still standing up, and then they increase, like, horses whinnying in the background.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre the way they did it.
And cows mooing and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, I think what you also mentioned, that there's a sequence after Gene and Cleavon don the KKK robes.
"Hey, where the white women at?"
Yeah. Where they run across some like a baptism.
Yeah, some evangelicals doing a baptism in a river. It's not a very funny sequence. I can see why they cut it.
Did you see any of the pilot? That pilot.
Well,
TV?
If you get the Blazing Saddles special edition DVD, the pilot, which was called Black Bart, and doesn't have it. None of the same cast is back.
No.
It was Louis Gossett Jr.
They showed it maybe one time.
They probably aired it one time.
The
N word is in that pilot TV show 25 times. And also, if you get the Blazing Saddles DVD, all the scenes that I just talked about, which were added to this TV print, are on the DVD as an extra, you know, deleted scenes extra. But the only way you could possibly see those scenes integrated within the film is if you had a 16mm print of this television version.
Yeah, I remember talking with my brother about that, and we were agreeing that because of all the censoring in Blazing Saddles, that it's not one to watch on broadcast TV, but, you know, something like Animal House is still pretty watchable. And I found the same with Airplane. Some of the cuts and the bleeps they were making were just very odd.
It's
really
it's
just
brutal
took the
to
life
watch
out of it.
Yeah.
But it's not unusual back in the late 70s for the network to do odd things to movies. I remember a movie, one of my favorite movies from the mid 70s with Charlton Heston, called Two Minute Warning was about a sniper at an NFL game.
Mm-hmm.
And it had one of these all-star castings. I think it was Walter Pidgeon's last movie, and John Cassavetes and General Rollins and all these people were in it. It ends with the sniper being taken down by the SWAT team, and you don't know anything about the sniper. Well, the network didn't want to broadcast a movie. I guess, I don't know, maybe they thought it would influence a terrorist act or something. So the network actually went in and filmed this whole subplot, about 40 minutes of this whole art heist going on at this museum next to the football stadium. And the sniper is causing a distraction so these guys can get away with this art heist. And it has nothing to do with what I'd seen at the theater.
Yeah. Well, I got, when we were talking about that earlier, I recalled seeing some Hammer films on NBC Saturday Night at the Movies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And particularly The Evil of Frankenstein and Kiss of Evil.
Sometimes called
Kiss of the Vampire.
Well, it's called Kiss of the Vampire, but when they aired it on TV with that footage you're talking about, they called it Kiss of Evil.
They actually added subplots. I think with Kiss of Evil, there was a whole subplot of this this fellow who was concerned about his daughter spending too much time at the house and at the Count's castle. With Evil of Frankenstein, there was a sequence with a father or a grandfather. It was concerned because his son would come back telling stories about meeting this huge giant in the forest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was, to fill out a two-hour time slot.
Yeah, but that was the first time, you know, a lot of movie buffs our age saw these movies was on network television. Another example was Dune. I think didn't they want to stretch out Dune to like two nights?
They
added about 45 minutes of outtakes, and David Lynch, who directed Dune, hated it and took his name off it.
Yeah.
So it's actually Alan Smithy, if you watch the TV. And that's actually, you can get that on DVD. They call it Dune, the Extended Cut, directed by Alan Smithy. But, you know, I guess they don't air movies on network television anymore.
Yeah, the last...
The thing of the past.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, the last couple of examples I recall were in, I guess, around 1982 when ABC broadcast Superman the movie.
ABC was notorious for adding...
And stretched it over two nights.
Exactly.
So we got a lot of extra footage of the earthquake stuff at the end of it. And we also got the that whole sequence of Superman going through the tunnels to Lex Luthor's lair, which I think they put back into the DVD, which is a great sequence with getting blasted with machine guns and cold and all that. Even as far back as, I guess, 1990, when CBS ran Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the pig's head scene was in, which is in the trailer, but was in the theatrical release, where Eddie Valiant has been roughed up by the weasels and wakes up, and he's got a pig's head, a cartoon pig's head attached to his head. So he goes into the shower and uses... you know, a version of the dip there, some, you know, some turpentine and all that to wash it away. And when he comes out of the shower, you know, with the towel around him, that's when he has his scene with Jessica Rabbit. She says, "I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way." You know, that
the promotions for it were great, though. I mean, this is prior to VHS and everything else. And you either saw it in the theater and then the next time you saw it was on TV. And so they would promote it like, you know, scenes you hadn't seen. And it was going to be an extra half hour. And it was like the big event of not just the week, but like of the month, because they were promoting this weeks out.
This is kind of along the same lines, but I do remember when Showgirls, which is one of my favorite movies, aired on, I guess, probably TNT. And there's all these scenes where Elizabeth Berkley's just running around totally nude. They actually put a computer-generated bikini on her. And it didn't look particularly realistic, but it followed her around, and it was quite humorous to watch.
Well, didn't they kind of do that with Diamonds Are Forever, with the Plenty O'Toole scene, I think I read, that they actually had sort of... superimposed a little area around her midsection or something like that.
Yeah, they probably did. I don't recall that. But even some studios used to shoot two versions
they
of
would.
Films.
Sure.
There was one that's off the top of my head. There was a Charles Bronson movie called 10 to Midnight about a naked serial killer who kills naked women. So they would film this actor killing these naked women, and then they would go back and they would shoot a version where he's wearing pants and they're wearing underwear or something else. So they're covered, and then that way they had the R-rated version that people could see at the theaters, and then they could re-edit a cleaner version for television. So that was, I don't know how common it was, but that happened a few times.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Did they do that also, I guess, with Goodfellas, you know? And really, I think I'd read somewhere that Scorsese, or maybe I'm thinking of Alex Cox with Repo Man, that he got a big kick out of shooting the airplane or the TV version and replacing all the obscenities in it with weird phrasing.
Well, if you get the Scarface DVD, there's an extra on there that has all the bad language in the TV version. So it runs about 10 minutes, and it's just all the dubbing. And so that becomes somewhat comical. You know, that's how I saw a lot of movies with these cut versions. I didn't catch up till I'm uncut until much later in life.
Yeah, and then like you say, they'd put in bonus stuff on TV sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that was amazing. And I recall a couple of times when, like, I remember seeing Gay Paris, the animated feature from the 60s. When that ran on CBS, they had Time to Kill, so they put in a couple of Pepe Le Pew cartoons at the end of the broadcast. That was great.
Those days when we had to watch movies on television with commercials, the whole works.
Yeah, now I think about the only time they'll run Hollywood features on TV is maybe on a Saturday night or something. That's become sort of a dumping ground for network television.
Right.
But it was a big deal. Every network had at least two or three, you know, nighttime movies back in the 60s and 70s. Unbelievable. We're old.
We are, but even I don't think if young movie buffs appreciate the challenge that we had of even seeing an R-rated movie. I mean, you'd have to get somebody to take you to the theater. You'd have to get somebody to buy your tickets.
And
I was sort of obsessed with R-rated movies,
and it wasn't commonplace like it is today. I mean,
most kids today can watch porno on their phone.
Right.
Well, I recall when The Exorcist opened, I was all prepared with an ID thing and all that, and they never asked, you know.
Yeah.
But I was ready just in case.
Oh, I used to ride my bike up to the DePere Theater when I was like 13, and I would ask strange men on the parking lot to buy my tickets to R-rated movies. Of course, now you'd probably get arrested for contributing to the delinquency of a minor or something like that. All right, well, we got to wrap it up. This has been fun, guys.
Always.
Next week, we'll be back with reviews of Hitman, Agent 47, Sinister 2, American Ultra, etc., etc. But we're going to sign off for now. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
Listen to us again next week at the We Are Movie Geeks podcast.
rock. Black leather, black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather, black leather.
Oh, nutty state. Hello, darling. Hey.
Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.